claimed never to have touched one.
Are you joking, Poor Fire?
No. He wouldn't say those things to me, but Poor Fire hears. Poor Fire always hears. He left for London the morning after you got here.
And what was it you heard he'd said?
That you're crazy. On shit or off. That you hear voices. That the net sacks know.
Voices. Who told you that?
She tried to turn in the chair.
Don't move your head.
There. He went back to his work.
I can't say.
Trust me.
There were a number of calls after Poor Fire left. Her production crew, eager to say hello. No more calls this afternoon, she told the house. I'll run the tally sequences upstairs. She found a bottle of Corona at the rear of the fridge and took it to the master bedroom. The stim unit in the teak headboard was equipped with studio-grade trodes that hadn't been there when she'd left for Jamaica. Net technicians periodically upgraded equipment in the house. She had a swig of beer, put the bottle on the bedside table, and laid down with the trodes across her forehead.
Okay, she said. Hit me.
Into tally flesh. Tally breath.
How did I ever replace you? She wondered, overcome by the former star's physical being. Do I give people this same pleasure?
Tally Angie, looking out across a vine-hung chasm that was also a boulevard, glancing up to the inverse horizon, squares of distant tennis courts. Freeside's sun, an axial thread of brilliance overhead.
Fast forward, she told the house.
Into smooth pumping muscle and a blur of concrete. Tally hurling her cycle around a low grav velodrome.
Fast forward.
A dining scene. Tension of velvet straps across her shoulders. The young man across the table leaning forward to pour more wine.
Fast forward.
Linen sheets. A hand between her legs. Purple twilight through plate glass. Sound of running water.
Reverse. The restaurant.
The red wine gurgling into her glass. Little more.
Hold it.
There. Tally's eyes had been focused on the boy's tanned wrist, not on the bottle.
I want a graphic of the visual, she said, pulling off the trodes.
She sat up and took a swallow of beer, which mingled weirdly with the ghost flavor of Tally's recorded wine. The printer downstairs chimed softly as it completed its task. She forced herself to take the stairs slowly, but when she reached the printer, in the kitchen, the image disappointed her.
"Can you clear this up?" she asked the house. "I want to be able to read the label on the bottle." "Justifying image," the house said, "and rotating target object 8 degrees.
The printer hummed softly as the new graphic was extruded. Angie found her treasure before the machine could chime. Her dream sigil in brown ink. T.A. They'd had their own vineyards, she thought. Tessier Ashpool, S.A. The typeface, regal and spidery.
Gotcha,
she whispered. Chapter 8. Texas Radio. Mona could see the sun through a couple of rips in the black plastic they kept taped over the window. She hated the squat too much to stay there when she was awake or straight. And now she was both. She got quietly out of bed, wincing when her bare heel brushed the floor, and fumbled for her plastic thongs. The place was dirty. You could probably get tetanus from leaning up against the wall. Made her skin crawl to think about it. Stuff like that didn't seem to bother Eddie. He was too far gone in his schemes to notice his surroundings much, and he always managed to keep clean somehow. Like a cat. He was cat clean. Never a fleck of dirt under his polished nails. She figured he probably spent most of what she earned on his wardrobe, although it wouldn't have occurred to her to question the fact. She was 16 and sinless, Mona. And this older trick had told her once that that was a song. 16 and sinless. Meant she hadn't been assigned a sin when she was born. A single identification number. So she'd grown up on the outside of most official systems. She knew that it was supposed to be possible to get a sin, if you didn't have one. But it stood to reason you'd have to go into a building somewhere and talk to a suit. And that was a long way from Mona's idea of a good time, or even normal behavior. She had a drill for getting dressed in the squat, and she could do it in the dark. You got your thongs on, after giving them a quick knock together to dislodge possible crawlies, and then you walked over to where you knew there was a roll of old facts on a styrofoam crate beside the window. You peeled off about a meter of facts, maybe a day and a half of Asahi Shimbun, folded and creased it, put it down on the floor. Then you could stand in it, get the plastic bag from beside the crate, undo the twist of wire that held it shut, and find the clothes you wanted. When you stepped out of the thongs to put your pants on, you knew you'd be stepping on fresh facts. It was an article of faith with Mona that nothing was going to wander across the facts in the time it took her to step into a pair of jeans and get the thongs back on. You could put on a shirt or whatever, carefully reseal the bag and get out of there. Makeup, when required, went on in the corridor outside. There was some mirror left beside the derelict elevator. A Fuji biofluorescent strip glued above it. There was a strong piss smell beside the elevator this morning. So she decided to skip the makeup. You never saw anybody in the building, but you heard them sometimes. Music through a closed door, or footsteps just gone around a corner at the far end of a corridor. Well, that made sense. Mona had no desire to meet her neighbors either. She took the stairs down three flights and into the gaping dark of the underground garage. She had her flashlight in her hand, found her way with six quick little blinks that steered her around stagnant puddles and dangling strands of dead optic cable up the concrete steps and out into the alley. You could smell the beach sometimes in the alley, if the wind was right, but today it just smelled of garbage. The side of the squat towered away above her, so she moved fast, before some asshole decided to drop a bottle. Or worse. Once she was out on the avenue, she slowed, but not too much. She was conscious of the cash in her pocket, and full of plans for spending it. Wouldn't do to get taken off. Not when it looked like Eddie had wrangled them some kind of ticket out. She alternated between telling herself it was a sure thing, that they were practically gone, and warning herself not to get her hopes up. She knew Eddie's sure things. Hadn't Florida been one of them? How it was warm in Florida and the beaches were beautiful and it was full of cute guys with money. Just the spot for a little working vacation that had already stretched into the longest month Mona could remember. Well, it was fucking hot in Florida. Like a sauna. The only beaches that weren't private were polluted. Dead fish rolling belly up in the shallows. Maybe the private stretches were the same, but you couldn't see them. Just the chain link and the guards in shorts and cop shirts standing around. Eddie'd get excited by the weapons the guards carried, and describe each one to her in numbing detail. He didn't have a gun himself, though, not as far as she knew, and Mona figured that was a good thing. Sometimes you couldn't even smell the dead fish, because there was another smell. A chlorine smell that burned the roof of your mouth. Something from the factories up the coast. If there were cute guys, they were still tricks. and the ones down here weren't exactly offering to pay double. About the only thing to like about Florida was drugs, which were easy to come by and cheap and mostly industrial strength. Sometimes she imagined the bleach smell was the smell of a million dope labs cooking some unthinkable cocktail. All those molecules thrashing their kinky little tails, hot for destiny in the street. She turned off the avenue and walked down a line of unlicensed food stalls. Her stomach started growling at the smell, but she didn't trust street food. Not if she didn't have to. And there were licensed places in the mall that would take cash. Somebody was playing a trumpet in the asphalt square that had been the parking lot. A rambling Cuban solo that bounced and distorted off the concrete walls. Dying notes lost in the morning clatter of the market. A soapbox evangelist spread his arms high. A pale, fuzzy Jesus, copying the gesture in the air above him. The projection rig was in the box he stood on. But he wore a battered nylon pack with two speakers sticking over each shoulder like blank chrome heads. The evangelist frowned up at Jesus and adjusted something on the belt at his waist. Jesus strobed, turned green, and vanished. Mona laughed. The man's eyes flashed God's wrath, a muscle working in his seamed cheek. Mona turned left, between rows of fruit vendors, stacking oranges and grapefruit in pyramids on their battered metal carts. She entered a low, cavernous building that housed aisles of more permanent businesses, sellers of fish and packaged foods, cheap household goods, counters serving a dozen kinds of hot food. It was cooler here in the shade, and a little quieter. She found a wonton place with six empty stools and took one. The Chinese cook spoke to her in Spanish. She ordered by pointing. He brought her soup in a plastic bowl. She paid him with the smallest of her bills, and he made change with eight greasy cardboard tokens. If Eddie meant it, about leaving, she wouldn't be able to use them. If they stayed in Florida, she could always get some wonton. She shook her head. Gotta go, gotta. She shoved the worn yellow discs back across the painted plyboard counter. You keep them. The cook swept them out of sight, bland and expressionless. A blue plastic toothpick fixed at the corner of his mouth. She took chopsticks from the glass on the counter and fished a folded noodle from the bowl. There was a suit watching her from the aisle behind the cook's pots and burners. A suit who was trying to look like something else. White sports shirt and sunglasses. More the way they stand than anything, she thought. But he had the teeth, too, and the haircut, except he had a beard. He was pretending to look around, like he was shopping, hands in his pockets, his mouth set in what he might have thought was an absent smile. He was pretty, the suit, what you could see of him behind the beard and the glasses. The smile wasn't pretty, though. It was kind of rectangular, so you could see most of his teeth. She shifted a little on the stool, uneasy. Hooking was legal, but only if you did it right. Got the tax chip and everything. She was suddenly aware of the cash in her pocket. She pretended to study the laminated food handling license taped to the counter. When she looked up again, he was gone. She spent 50 on the clothes. She worked her way through 18 racks and 4 shops, everything the mall had, before she made up her mind. The vendors didn't like her trying on so many things, but it was the most she'd ever had to spend. It was noon before she'd finished, and the Florida sun was cooking the pavement as she crossed the parking lot with her two plastic bags. The bags, like the clothes, were secondhand. One was printed with the logo of a Ginza shoe store. The other advertised Argentinian seafood briquettes, molded from reconstituted krill. She was mentally mixing and matching the things she'd bought, figuring out different outfits. From the other side of the square, the evangelist opened up at full volume in mid-rant, like he'd warmed up to a spit-spraying fury before he'd cut the amp in, the hologram Jesus shaking its white-robed arms and gesturing angrily to the sky, the mall, the sky again. "Rapture," he said. "Rapture's coming." Mona turned a corner at random, automatic reflex, avoiding a crazy, and found herself walking past sun-faded card tables, spread with cheap Indo SimStim sets, used cassettes, colored spikes of Microsoft stuck in blocks of pale blue styrofoam. There was a picture of Angie Mitchell taped up behind one of the tables, a poster Mona hadn't seen before. She stopped and studied it hungrily, taking in the star's clothes and makeup first, then trying to figure out the background where it had been shot. Unconsciously, she adjusted her expression to approximate Angie's in the poster. Not a grin, exactly. A sort of half-grin. Maybe a little sad. Mona felt a special way about Angie. Because, and Trick said it sometimes, she looked like her. Like she was Angie's sister. Except her nose. Mona's had more of a tilt, and she, Angie, didn't have that smear of freckles out her cheekbones. Mona's Angie half-grin widened as she stared, washed in the beauty of the poster, the luxury of the pictured room. She guessed it was a kind of castle. Probably it was where Angie lived, sure, with lots of people to take care of her, do her hair and hang up her clothes, because you could see the walls were made of big rocks, and those mirrors had frames on them that were solid gold, carved with leaves and angels. The writing across the bottom would say where it was, maybe, but Mona couldn't read. Anyway, there weren't any fucking roaches there, she was sure of that, and no Eddie either. She looked down at the stim sets and briefly considered using the rest of her money. But then she wouldn't have enough for a stim, and anyway, these were old, some of them older than she was. There was, what's it, that Tally. She'd been big when Mona was maybe 9. When she got back, Eddie was waiting for her, with the tape off the window and the flies buzzing. Eddie was sprawled out on the bed, smoking a cigarette. And the suit with the beard, who had been watching her, was sitting in the broken chair, still wearing his sunglasses. Pryor. He said that was his name, like he didn't have a first one. Or like Eddie didn't have a last one. Well, she didn't have a last name herself, unless you counted Lisa. And that was more like having two first ones. She couldn't get much sense of him in the squat. She thought maybe that was because he was English. He wasn't really a suit, though. Not like she'd thought when she'd seen him in the mall. He was onto some game. It just wasn't clear which one. He kept his eyes on her a lot. Watched her pack her things in the blue Lufthansa bag he'd brought, but she couldn't feel any heat there. Not like he wanted her. He just watched her. Watched Eddie smoke, tapped his sunglasses on his knee, listened to Eddie's line of bullshit, and said as little as he needed to. When he did say something, it was usually funny. But the way he talked made it hard to tell when he was joking. Packing, she felt lightheaded. Like she'd done a jumper, but it hadn't quite come on. The flies were fucking against the window, bumping on the dust-streaked glass. But she didn't care. Gone. She was already gone. Zipping up the bag. It was raining when they got to the airport. Florida rain. Pissing down warm out of a nowhere sky. She'd never been to an airport before. but she knew them from the stems. Pryor's car was a white Datsun rental that drove itself and played elevator music through quad speakers. It left them beside their luggage in a bare concrete bay and drove away in the rain. If Pryor had a bag, it wasn't with him. Mona had her Lufthansa bag, and Eddie had two black gator clone suitcases. She tugged her new skirt down over her hips and wondered if she'd bought the right shoes. Eddie was enjoying himself, had his hands in his pockets and his shoulders tilted to show he was doing something important. She remembered him in Cleveland the first time, how he'd come out to the place to look at a scoot the old man had for sale, a three-wheel Skoda that was mostly rust. The old man grew catfish in concrete tanks that fenced the dirt yard. She was in the house when Eddie came, long, high-walled space of a truck trailer up on blocks. There were windows cut down one side, square holes sealed over with scratched plastic. She was standing by the stove, smell of onions and sacks and tomatoes hung up to dry, when she felt him there, down the length of the room, sensed the muscle and shoulder of him, his white teeth, the black nylon cap held shyly in his hand. Sun was coming in the windows. The place lit up, bare and plain. The floor swept the way the old man had her keep it. But it was like a shadow came. Blood shadow, where she heard the pumping of her heart, and him coming closer, tossing the cap on the bare chipboard table as he passed it, not shy now, but like he lived there, right up to her, running a hand with a bright ring back through the oiled weight of his hair. The old man came in then, and Mona turned away, pretended to do something with the stove. "Coffee," the old man said, and Mona went to get some water, filling the enamel pot from the roof tank line, the water gurgling down through the charcoal filter. Eddie and the old man sitting at the table, drinking black coffee. Eddie's legs spread straight out under the table, thighs hard through threadbare denim. Smiling, jiving the old man, dealing for the Skoda. How it seemed to run okay. How he'd buy it if the old man had the title. Old man getting up to dig in a drawer. Eddie's eyes on her again. She followed them out into the yard and watched him straddle the cracked vinyl saddle. Backfire set the old man's black dogs yelping, high sweet smell of cheap alcohol exhaust, and the frame trembling between his legs. Now she watched him pose beside his suitcases, and it was hard to connect that up. Why she'd left with him next day on the Skoda, headed into Cleveland. The Skoda had a busted little radio you couldn't hear over the engine. Just play it soft at night in a field by the road. Tuner part was cracked, so it only picked up one station. Ghost music, up from some lonesome tower in Texas. Steel guitar, fading in and out all night. Feeling how she was wet against his leg, and the stiff dry grass prickling the back of her neck. Pryor put her blue bag into a white cart with a striped top, and she climbed in after it, hearing tiny Spanish voices from the Cuban driver's headset. Then Eddie stowed the gator cases, and he and Pryor got in, rolling out to the runway through walls of rain. The plane wasn't what she knew from the stims, not like a long, rich bus inside with lots of seats. It was a little black thing with sharp, skinny wings and windows that made it look like it was squinting. She went up some metal stairs, and there was a space with four seats and the same gray carpet all over, on the walls and ceiling, too. Everything clean and cool and gray. Eddie came in after her and took a seat like it was something he did every day, loosening his tie and stretching his legs. Pryor was pushing buttons beside the door. It made a sighing sound when it closed. She looked out the narrow, streaming windows at runway lights reflected on wet concrete.
came down here on the train, she thought. New York to Atlanta, and then you change.
The plane shivered. She heard the airframe creak as it came to life. She woke briefly, 2 hours later, in the darkened cabin, cradled by the long hum of the jet. Eddie was asleep, his mouth half open. Maybe Pryor was sleeping too, or maybe he just had his eyes closed, she couldn't tell. Halfway back into a dream she wouldn't remember in the morning, she heard the sound of that Texas radio. Fading steel chords, drawn out like an ache. Chapter 9. Underground. Jubilee and Bakerloo, Circle and District. Kumiko peered at the little laminated map Petal had given her and shivered. The concrete platform seemed to radiate cold through the soles of her boots. It's so fucking old, Sally Shear said absently, her glasses reflecting a convex wall sheathed in white ceramic tile.
I beg your pardon?
The tube. A new tartan scarf was knotted under Sally's chin, and her breath was white when she spoke. You know what bothers me? It's how sometimes you'll see them sticking new tile up in these stations, but they don't take down the old tile first. Or they'll punch a hole in the wall to get to some wiring, and you can see all these different layers of tile.
Yes?
Because it's getting narrower, right? It's like arterial plaque.
Yes?
Kumiko said dubiously.
I see. Those boys, Sally, what is the meaning of their costume, please?
Jacks. What they call Jack Draculas. The four Jack Draculas huddled like ravens on the opposite platform. They wore nondescript black raincoats and polished black combat boots laced to the knee. One turned to address another, and Kumiko saw that his hair was drawn back into a plaited queue and bound with a small black bow.
Hung him, Sally said. After the war. Who?
Jack Dracula. They had public hangings for a while after the war.
Jax, you want to stay away from him. Hate anybody foreign.
Kumiko would have liked to access Colin, but the Mas Neotech unit was tucked behind a marble bust in the room where Petals served their meals, and then the train arrived, amazing her with the archaic thunder of wheels on steel rail. Sally Shears, against the patchwork backdrop of the city's architecture, her glasses reflecting the London jumble, each period culled by economics, by fire, by war. Kumiko, already confused by three rapid and apparently random train changes, let herself be hauled through a sequence of taxi rides. They'd jump out of one cab, march into the nearest large store, then take the first available exit to another street and another cab.
Harrods,
Sally said at one point, as they cut briskly through an ornate tile-walled hall pillared in marble. Kumiko blinked at thick red roasts and shanks displayed on tiered marble counters, assuming they were made of plastic. And then out again, Sally hailing the next cab.
Covent Garden,
she said to the driver.
Excuse me, Sally, what are we doing?
Getting lost.
Sally drank hot brandy in a tiny cafe beneath the snow-streaked glass roof of the piazza. Kumiko drank chocolate.
Are we lost, Sally?
Yeah.
Hope so anyway.
She looked older today, Kumiko thought, lines of tension or fatigue around her mouth.
Sally, what is it that you do? Your friend asked if you were still retired.
I'm a businesswoman.
and my father is a businessman?
Your father is a businessman, honey. No, not like that.
I'm an indie.
I make investments, mostly.
In what do you invest?
In other indies. She shrugged. Feeling curious today? She sipped her brandy.
You advised me to be my own spy.
Good advice. Takes a light touch, though.
Do you live here, Sally, in London?
I travel.
Is Swain another indie?
He thinks so. He's into influence, nods in the right direction. You need that here to do business, but it gets on my nerves. She tossed back the rest of the brandy and licked her lips. Kumiko shivered. You don't have to be scared of Swain. Yanaka could have him for breakfast.
No, I thought of those boys in the subway. So thin.
The Draculas.
A gang?
Bosazoku, Sally said with fair pronunciation.
Running tribes?
Anyway, like a tribe. It wasn't the right word, but Kumiko thought she saw the distinction. They're thin because they're poor. She gestured to the waiter for a second brandy.
Sally, Kumiko said, when we came here, the route we took, the trains and cabs, that was in order to make certain we were not followed.
Nothing's ever certain.
But when we went to meet Tick, you took no precautions. We could easily have been followed. You enlist Tick to spy on Swain, yet you take no precautions. You bring me here. You take many precautions. Why?
The waiter put a steaming glass down in front of her. You're a sharp little honey, aren't you? She leaned forward and inhaled the fumes of brandy. It's like this, okay? With Tick, maybe I'm just trying to shake some action.
But Tick is concerned that Swain not discover him.
Swain won't touch him. Not if he knows he's working for me.
Why?
Because he knows I might kill him. She raised the glass, looking suddenly happier.
Kill Swain?
That's right. She drank.
Then why were you so cautious today?
Because sometimes it feels good to shake it all off. Get out from under. Chances are we haven't. But maybe we have. Maybe nobody at all knows where we are. Nice feeling, huh? You could be kinked. You ever think of that? Maybe your dad, the yak warlord, he's got a little bug planted in you so he can keep track of his daughter.
You got those pretty little teeth. Maybe Daddy's dentist tucked a little hardware in there one time when you were into a stim.
You go to the dentist?
Yes.
You stim while he works?
Yes.
There you go. Maybe he's listening to us right now. Kumiko nearly overturned what was left of her chocolate. Hey. The polished nails tapped Kumiko's wrist. Don't worry about it. He wouldn't have sent you here like that, with a bug. Make you too easy for his enemies to track. But you see what I mean? It's good to get out from under. Or anyway, try. On our own, right?
Yes,
Kumiko said, her heart still pounding. The panic continuing to rise.
He killed my mother,
she blurted, then vomited chocolate on the cafe's gray marble floor. Sally leading her past the columns of St. Paul's, walking, not talking. Kumiko in a disjointed trance of shame, registering random information. The white shearling that lined Sally's leather coat. The oily rainbow sheen of a pigeon's feathers as it waddled out of their way. Red buses like a giant's toys in the transport museum. Sally warming her hands around a foam cup of steaming tea. Cold. It would always be cold now. The freezing damp in the city's ancient bones. The cold waters of Sumida that had filled her mother's lungs. The chill flight of the neon cranes. Her mother was fine-boned and dark, the thick spill of her hair grained with gold highlights like some rare tropical hardwood. Her mother smelled of perfume and warm skin. Her mother told her stories about elves and fairies and Copenhagen, which was a city far away. When Kumiko dreamed of the elves, they were like her father's secretaries, lithe and staid, with black suits and furled umbrellas. The elves did many curious things in her mother's stories, and the stories were magic, because they changed with the telling, and you could never be certain how a tale might end on a given night. There were princesses in the stories as well, and ballerinas, and each of them, Kumiko had known, was in some way her mother. The princess ballerinas were beautiful but poor, dancing for love in the far city's heart, where they were courted by artists and student poets, handsome and penniless. In order to support an aged parent or purchase an organ for an ailing brother, a princess ballerina was sometimes obliged to voyage very far indeed, perhaps as far as Tokyo, to dance for money. Dancing for money, the tales implied, was not a happy thing. Sally took her to a Robata bar in Earl's Court and forced her to drink a glass of sake. A smoked fugafin floated in the hot wine, turning it the color of whiskey. They ate Robata from the smoky grill, and Kumiko felt the cold recede, but not the numbness. The decor of the bar induced a profound sense of cultural dislocation. It managed to simultaneously reflect traditional Japanese design and look as though it had been drawn up by Charles Rennie Mackintosh. She was very strange, Sally Shears, stranger than all of Gaijin London. Now she told Kumiko stories. Stories about people who lived in a Japan Kumiko had never known. Stories that defined her father's role in the world. The Oyabun, she called Kumiko's father. The world Sally's stories described seemed no more real than the world of her mother's fairy tales. But Kumiko began to understand the basis and extent of her father's power. Kuromaku, Sally said. The word meant black curtain. It's from Kabuki, but it means a fixer, someone who sells favors. Means behind the scenes, right? That's your father. That's Swain, too. But Swain's your old man's kobun, or anyway one of them. Oyabun kobun, parent-child. That's partly where Roger gets his juice. That's why you're here now. Because Roger owes it to the Oyabun. Giri? Understand? He is a man of rank. Sally shook her head. Your old man, Kumi, he's it. If he's had to ship you out of town to keep you safe, means there's some serious changes on the way.
Been down the drinker? Petal asked, as they entered the room, his eyeglass edges winking Tiffany light from a bronze and stained glass tree that grew on the sideboard. Kumiko wanted to look at the marble head that hid the Mas Neotech unit, but forced herself to look out into the garden.
the snow there had become the color of London sky.
"Where's Swain?" Sally asked.
"Governor's out,"
Petal told her. Sally went to the sideboard and poured herself a glass of scotch from a heavy decanter. Kumiko saw Petal wince as the decanter came down hard on the polished wood.
"Any messages?"
"No."
"Expect him back tonight?"
"Can't say, really. Do you want dinner?"
"No."
"I'd like a sandwich," Kumiko said.
15 minutes later, with the untouched sandwich on the black marble bedside table, she sat in the middle of the huge bed, the Moss Neotech unit between her bare feet. She'd left Sally drinking Swain's whiskey and staring out into the gray garden. Now she took up the unit, and Colin shuddered into focus at the foot of the bed.
"Nobody can hear my half of this,"
he said quickly, putting a finger to his lips.
"And a good thing, too. Room's bugged."
Kumiko started to reply, then nodded.
"Good," he said. "Smart girl. Got two conversations for you. One's your host and his minder. Other's your host and Sally. Got the form about 15 minutes after you stashed me downstairs. Listen."
Kumiko closed her eyes and heard the tinkle of ice in a whiskey glass.
"Where's our little Jap, then?"
Swain asked.
"Tucked up for the night,"
Petal said.
"Talks to herself, that one. One-sided conversation. Queer."
"What about?"
"Bloody little, actually. Some people do, you know."
"What?"
"Talk to themselves. Like to hear?"
"Christ, no. Where's the delightful Miss Shears?"
"Out for her constitutional.
Call Bernie round next time. See what she's about on these little walks."
"Bernie!"
And Petal laughed.
"He'd come back in a fucking box."
Now Swain laughed.
"Mightn't be a bad thing either way. Bernard off our hands, and the famous razor girl's thirst slaked. Here, pour us another."
"None for me. Off to bed, unless you need me."
"No,"
Swain said. "So," said Colin, as Kumiko opened her eyes to find him still seated on the bed.
"There's a voice-activated bug here in your room. The minder reviewed the recording and heard you address me. Our second segment now is more interesting. Your host sits there with his second whiskey. In comes our Sally."
"Hello?"
she heard Swain say.
"Been out taking the air?"
"Fuck off."
"You know," Swain said, "none of this was my idea. You might try keeping that in mind. You know they've got me by the balls as well."
"You know, Roger, sometimes I'm tempted to believe you."
"Try it. It would make things easier."
"Other times, I'm tempted to slit your fucking throat."
"Your problem, dear, is that you never learn to delegate. You still want to do everything personally."
"Listen, asshole. I know where you're from. And I know how you got here. And I don't care how far you've got your tongue up Kanaka's crack or anybody else's. Sarakin."
Kumiko had never heard the word before.
"I heard from them again,"
Swain said, his tone even, conversational.
"She's still on the coast, but it looks as though she'll make a move soon. East, most likely. Back on your old manor. I think that's our best bet, really. The house is impossible. Enough private security along that stretch to stop a fair-sized army."
"You still trying to tell me this is just a snatch, Roger? Trying to tell me they're gonna hold her for ransom?"
"No. Nothing's been said about selling her back."
So why don't they just hire that army? No reason they'd have to stop at fair-sized, is there? Get the mercs, right? The corporate extraction boys. She's not that hard a target. No more than some hotshit research man. Get the fucking pros in. For perhaps the 100th time, that isn't what they want. They want you. Roger. What do they have on you, huh? I mean, do you really not know what it is they got on me? No, I don't. But based on what they've got on me, I'll hazard a guess. Yeah? Everything. No reply. There's another angle, he said, that came up today. They wanted to look as though she's been taken out.
What?
They wanted to look as though we've killed her.
And how are we supposed to manage that?
They'll provide a body.
I assume, Colin said, that she left the room without comment. It ends there.
Chapter 10. The Shape. He spent an hour checking the saw's bearings, then lubed them again. It was already too cold to work. He'd have to go ahead and heat the room where he kept the others, the investigators and the corpse grinder and the witch. That in itself would be enough to disturb the balance of his arrangement with Gentry. But it faded beside the problem of explaining his agreement with Kid Africa and the fact of two strangers in factory. There was no way to argue with Gentry. The juice was his, because he was the one who fiddled it out of the Fission Authority. Without Gentry's monthly passes on the console, the ritual moves that kept the Authority convinced Factory was somewhere else, some place that paid its bill, there wouldn't be any electricity. And Gentry was so strange anyway, he thought, feeling his knees creak as he stood up and took the judge's control unit from his jacket pocket. Gentry was convinced that cyberspace had a shape, an overall, total form. Not that that was the weirdest idea Slick had ever run across, but Gentry had this obsessive conviction that the shape mattered totally. The apprehension of the shape was Gentry's grail. Slick had once stimmed a net knowledge sequence about what shape the universe was. Slick figured the universe was everything there was. So how could it have a shape? If it had a shape, then there was something around it for it to have a shape in, wasn't there? And if that something was something, then wasn't that part of the universe too? This was exactly the kind of thing you didn't want to get into with Gentry, because Gentry could tie your head in knots. But Slick didn't think cyberspace was anything like the universe anyway. It was just a way of representing data. The Fission Authority had always looked like a big red Aztec pyramid, but it didn't have to. If the FA wanted it to, they could have it look like anything. Big companies had copyrights on how their stuff looked. So how could you figure the whole matrix had a particular shape? And why should it mean anything if it did? He touched the unit's power stud. The judge, 10 meters away, hummed and trembled. Slick Henry hated the judge. That was what the art people never understood. That didn't mean it didn't give him pleasure to have built the thing, to have gotten the judge out, out where he could see him and keep track of him, and finally, sort of, be free of the idea of him. But that sure wasn't the same as liking him. Nearly 4 meters tall, half as broad at the shoulders, headless, the judge stood trembling in his patchwork carapace, the color of rust gone a certain way,
like the handles of an old wheelbarrow, polished by the friction of 1,000 hands. He'd found a way to get that surface with chemicals and abrasives, and he'd used it on most of the judge. The old parts anyway, the scavenged parts, not the cold teeth of the circular blades or the mirrored surfaces of the joints. But the rest of the judge was that color, that finish, like a very old tool still in hard daily use. He thumbed the joystick, and the judge took one step forward, then another. The gyros were working perfectly. Even with an arm off, the thing moved with a terrible dignity, planting its huge feet just so. Slick grinned in factory's gloom as the judge clomped toward him, 1, 2, 1, 2. He could remember every step of the judge's construction, if he wanted to, and sometimes he did, just for the comfort of being able to. He couldn't remember when he hadn't been able to remember, but sometimes he almost could. That was why he had built the judge. Because he'd done something. It hadn't been anything much, but he'd been caught doing it. Twice. And been judged for it. And sentenced. And then the sentence was carried out, and he hadn't been able to remember. Not anything. Not for more than 5 minutes at a stretch. Stealing cars. Stealing rich people's cars. They made sure you remembered what you did. Working the joystick, he got the judge turned around and walked him into the next room, along an aisle between rows of damp-stained concrete pads that had once supported lathes and spot welders. High overhead, up in the gloom and dusty beams, dangled dead fluorescent fixtures, where birds sometimes nested. Korsakovs, they called that. Something they did to your neurons so that short-term memories wouldn't stick. So that the time you did was time you lost. But he'd heard they didn't do it anymore, or anyway, not for Grand Theft Auto. People who hadn't been there thought it sounded easy. Like jail, but then it's all erased. But it wasn't like that. When he'd gotten out, when it was over, 3 years strung out in a long, vague, flickering chain of fear and confusion measured off in 5-minute intervals. And it wasn't the intervals you could remember, so much as the transitions. When it was over, he'd needed to build the witch, the corpse grinder, then the investigators, and finally, now the judge. As he guided the judge up the concrete ramp to the room where the others waited, he heard Gentry gunning his motor out on Dog Solitude. People made Gentry uncomfortable, Slick thought as he headed for the stairs, but it worked both ways. Strangers could feel the shape burning behind Gentry's eyes. His fixation came across in everything he did. Slick had no idea how he got along on his trips to the sprawl. Maybe he just dealt with people who were as intense as he was. Loners on the jagged fringes of the drug and software markets. He didn't seem to care about sex at all, to the extent that Slick had no idea what it was he'd have wanted if he decided to care. Sex was the solitude's main drawback, as far as Slick was concerned, particularly in the winter. Summers, sometimes, he could find a girl in one of those rusty little towns. That was what had taken him to Atlantic City that time, and gotten him in the kids' debt. Lately, he told himself the best solution was just to concentrate on his work. But climbing the shuddering steel stairs to the catwalk that led to Gentry's space, he found himself wondering what Cherry Chesterfield looked like under all those jackets. He thought about her hands, how they were clean and quick. But that made him see the unconscious face of the man on the stretcher, the tube feeding stuff into his left nostril.
Jerry dabbing at his sunken cheeks with a tissue. Made him wince.
"Hey, Gentry!"
he bellowed out into the iron void of factory.
"Coming up!"
Three things about Gentry weren't sharp and thin and tight. His eyes, his lips, his hair. His eyes were large and pale, gray or blue, depending on the light. His lips were full and mobile. His hair was swept back into a ragged blonde rooster tail that quivered when he walked. His thinness wasn't bird's emaciation, born of a Stringtown diet and bad nerves. Gentry was just narrow. The muscle packed in close. No fat at all. He dressed sharp and tight, too. Black leather trimmed with jet-black beads. A style Slick remembered from his days in the Deacon Blues. The beads, as much as anything, made Slick think he was about 30. Slick was about 30 himself. Gentry stared as Slick stepped through the door into the glare of 10 100-watt bulbs, making sure Slick knew he was another obstacle coming between Gentry and the shape. He was putting a pair of motorcycle panniers up on his long steel table. They looked heavy. Slick had cut roof panels away, installed struts where needed, covered the holes with sheets of rigid plastic, caulking the resulting skylights with silicone. Then Gentry came in with a mask and a sprayer and 20 gallons of white latex paint. He didn't dust or clean anything, just lay down a thick coat over all the crud and desiccated pigeon shit, sort of glued it all down and painted over it again, until it was more or less white. He painted everything but the skylights. Then Slick started winching gear up from factory's floor. A small truckload of computers, cyberspace decks, a huge old hollow projection table that nearly broke the winch, effect generators, dozens of corrugated plastic cartons stuffed with the thousands of fish Gentry had accumulated in his quest for the shape. Hundreds of meters of optics on bright new plastic reels. That spoke to Slick of industrial theft. And books. Old books with covers made of cloth glued over cardboard. Slick hadn't ever known how heavy books were. They had a sad smell. Old books. "You're pulling a few more amps since I left," Gentry said, opening the first of the two panniers. "In your room. Get a new heater?" He began to root quickly through the contents, as though he were looking for something he needed but had misplaced. He wasn't, though, Slick knew. It was having to have someone, even someone he knew, unexpectedly in his space.
"Yeah, I gotta heat the storage area again, too. Too cold to work otherwise."
"No," Gentry said, looking up suddenly. "That's not a heater in your room. The amperage is wrong."
"Yeah,"
Slick grinned, on the theory that grinning made Gentry think he was stupid and easily cowed.
"Yeah what, Slick Henry?"
"It's not a heater."
Gentry closed the pannier with a snap.
"You can tell me what it is, or I can cut your power."
"You know, Gentry, I wasn't around here. You'd have a lot less time for things."
Slick raised his eyebrows meaningfully in the direction of the big projection table.
"Fact is, I got two people staying with me."
He saw Gentry stiffen, the pale eyes widen.
"But you won't see either of them, won't hear them, nothing."
"No,"
Gentry said, his voice tight, as he rounded the end of the table.
"Because you're going to get them out of here, aren't you?"
"2 weeks max, Gentry."
"Out? Now!"
Gentry's face was inches away, and Slick smelled the sour breath of exhaustion.
or you go with them.
Slick outweighed Gentry by 10 kilos. Most of it muscle. But that had